the books right after this panel. So, Tiffany, please come up. And we are going to start this panel. Thank you.
All right, I'd like to invite the rest of my panelists to also join me. Thank you. And each of these amazing women is going to introduce themselves. Thank you. And welcome, everyone. Thanks so much for coming out and joining us today. It's such an important conversation, and it is an honor to be here. Start here with Zaniah. Tell us about yourself.
Hi, so my name is Zaniah Lewis. I'm a junior at George Washington University, and I'm studying political science. I'm also the founder and executive director of the Yes, She Can campaign, which is a 501c3 youth-led nonprofit that inspires and empowers young women to share their stories. And we provide educational resources to girls and young women across the country, and organizations run by high school and college students from across the country.
My name is Dani Rylan, and I'm the founder and commissioner of the National Women's Hockey League. The NWHL is the first professional women's hockey league in North America. We are going into our fourth season. We started with four teams on the Northeast in Boston, Buffalo, Connecticut, and New York City. And this past off season, we just expanded to the great state of hockey, Minnesota. And our season started last weekend, so we are off and running and very grateful to be here and impressed with the turnout. So thank you for showing up.
Hi guys, my name's Alexa Curtis, and back in 2011 I started a fashion blog because I was from a really small town and bullied and had a lot of body image issues, and my father when I was growing up was wrongfully convicted and put in prison for my childhood. So I started a fashion blog, and over the past 6 years have built it into this full-time lifestyle site for teens on social media and mental health that I run along with my nonprofit called Mint on the same topic, and a show that I host on Radio Disney called Fearless Every Day.
Fantastic. Thank you. So we're going to get into a conversation in a few minutes about bias and how it affects all of us, and we're going to have the wonderful opportunity to hear from each of these women about how unconscious bias and bias has affected them and how they've overcome it in the context of the amazing Herculean feats that they've accomplished at such young ages. So as a diversity, equity, and inclusion practitioner, I work in this space all day, every day, like in my current home state of Virginia, across the United States and across the world. And an unconscious bias, in case anyone has not heard and kind of picked up that memo, it is a bias itself is just a preference for or against one thing or another. And in the grand scheme of the world, a bias is not that big of a deal if we're talking about like ice cream. I like strawberry ice cream, you like vanilla ice cream. That really doesn't matter. No one gets bent out of shape about that. But the problem is our brains are actually hardwired for bias because our brains are fundamentally lazy. It takes glucose, like blood sugar, to actually run your brain, and it makes shortcuts, and it doesn't stop when it gets to people. So if I say chocolate ice cream is my favorite, hey, what's yours? No problem. But if I say chocolate people are my favorite, what's yours? It's like, oh gosh, did you just say that? Right. So unconscious bias is the kind of bias that you can have in your brain operating on your proverbial hard drive that you may not even be aware of. And if you are human people who's alive, you have bias. And this is the crazy thing. Some people might be sitting in the audience thinking, okay, blue-haired lady, I don't have bias because my parents, they raised me well. Whoever takes care of me, I've got that good home training. I treat everyone the same. No, we all have unconscious bias. And so we all have a responsibility to take it upon ourselves to try to figure out what those biases are, and there's lots of ways to do that. When you find yourself getting, kind of hot around the collar and you're like talking really fast and you get really agitated, your body actually gives you physical cues when you know something's going on. For instance, the immigration conversation, when that conversation comes up and we're talking particularly about people south of the border, I was born in El Paso, Texas. I spoke Spanish first, not because I'm like Hispanic or Latinx, right, or Latina. It's because the people who raised me, the people who took care of me, my friends and my babysitters were Spanish-speaking people from Mexico. So that feels like family to me. So when people start going off about immigration, I'm like, yo, y'all talking about my family right now. And I get like heated. I can, like, right now, hairs are standing up on my arms. So when you start to get signals from your body that you're like not feeling a certain way and not feeling real good about something, pay attention to those cues and know that we are all subject to bias. And then you also might be sometimes the victim of bias, and we're going to hear a little bit about that from our panelists, the times that we have experienced bias ourselves. When you're on the receiving end of it, what do you do? Because you can't control other people. You can't change other people. The most important thing that we can do is look at our own experiences and make sure that we're not letting our biases affect how we treat other people, right? So if I'm telling you here today, unequivocally, if you are human, you've got bias. It's important for you to start figuring out which ones you might have. And again, not your fault that you have them. In fact, you got them probably from the good people who've tried to raise you well. You picked them up from the media. You picked them up from movies, from books, from radio, from television, from Facebook, from Instagram. Your brain is constantly being inundated. Like, you all have access to more information right now than humanity has ever had in the history of ever. And all of that information is not like just getting lost on the hard drive. Things are getting locked in there. Like if I say kindergarten teacher, what do you think of? Just yell it out. If I say lawyer, what do you think of?
Scary.
If I say politician, what do you think of?
Scary.
If I say used car salesperson, what do you think of? Right, so all of these are like preconceived notions, biases, things that are based on stereotypes, based on data that you received a long time ago. And so sometimes, and you'll find as you start, for those of you who are young folks in the audience, as you come of age, you'll start having experiences where you'll be like, whoa, I had a real strong opinion about that person and I don't know where it came from. And you'll start to think, in some cases, you'll disagree with the people who raised you and you'll be like, oh, my parents said that such and such a group, not so cool, but I've got some really amazing friends from that group. So listen to those impulses. When you hear yourself doubting what you think you know, find out what's true. Like, go get, have more information. And the most important thing is, if you're not going to be a perpetrator of bias, then every single time you come across a human being, be fully present with that person and allow them to be who they are. Because your human instinct is that in the first 6 seconds of meeting someone, you've made a bajillion decisions about who you think they are, based on what you can see, if you can hear an accent, if you see, you know, skin color. You've made assumptions about gender. You might have made assumptions about their sexual orientation, their intelligence, all kinds of things. And that's okay. It's being human. It's not because you're a bad person. But push that stuff aside and let that person be who they are and show you who they are. And just because you have a negative experience with one person from one group does not mean that we can discount that entire group. I made that mistake. And if you read my book, Overcoming Bias, you'll hear about how I just like dismissed a whole entire demographic of people based on some bad experiences and had to come and get over that. And then Erasing Institutional Bias, the second book that I'll be signing, is about if you're just one person, but you can see bias working at a systemic level, like, hey, the girls in my school are having a really bad time, it teaches you how to deal with systems level bias. When you've got a whole organization or a whole system that is oppressing one group of people at a time. So that's my song and dance. I hope you enjoyed it. Now we're gonna get into talking to these ladies. Is that cool?
Yeah.
All right. All right. So I'm going to start with Alexa, okay? When you began a life in the fashion lane in 2011, it was a fashion blog, and you were, wait for it, 12 years old. Over the years, you've built a company. You've spoken about being discriminated against for certain opportunities because of your age. How did you learn to overcome that and not get frustrated when people didn't take you seriously?
Yeah, so that's an interesting topic because now we have millennials, Generation X, Y, whatever, all these different kids and groups of people who have grown up in different times. When I was growing up, it wasn't really the age of social media. I'm 20 now, so that was like over 6 years ago. And I was growing up right when social media was kind of on the bud of about to become what it is now, but nowhere near. So I didn't have the same opportunities. So it was constantly pushing down doors and forcing people to give me a chance. But I almost at the beginning really just didn't disclose my age. Now when you think, oh, it's cool, I was 12, I started a blog. But at the beginning, it was something I would never disclose and only in certain opportunities. And I think in a sense, it's very similar to whether or not you got a college degree nowadays. You have to pick and choose when you disclose what your age is. And for me now, I talk about it openly, and I don't care if somebody doesn't give me the opportunity that I deserve because of that, as frustrating as it is. But I think that if you can recognize the importance of confidence and this inner innate confidence that you have in yourself, certain obstacles like that, as annoying and frustrating as they are, kind of start to just become background noise, and the opportunities that you are given or present to yourself that don't discriminate against your age or your gender or whatever, or your skin color, they don't become as frustrating, if that makes sense.
Awesome, thank you. And Zaniah, how does the Yes She Can campaign help girls and young women overcome biases and obstacles? And what inspired you to create that campaign?
Yes. So the Yes She Can campaign started as an Instagram account where we just shared the stories of women who were overcoming adversity while they were striving to complete their education. So I knew, like, when I was going to school, a lot of my friends were overcoming adversity, from discrimination to just financial hardships. Also, I grew up as a military kid, and so a lot of them were experiencing deployments with their parents, and that was really hard on them going to school. And so I knew for me, sharing my story gave me the confidence and helped me break barriers as well. In 2016, I won a contest with 17 Magazine, where I was able to share my story about how I overcame adversity, and I was able to appear on the cover with former First Lady Michelle Obama and interview her at the White House. And so that really inspired me to just make sure I give more opportunities to girls and young women across the country. And so the Yes She Can campaign, we just provide girls and young women a platform to share their story, but we also understand the hardships that they go through. So many of them can't afford to go to college. So we have a scholarship list that goes out every week to make sure that girls are applying to scholarships. Some of them said they didn't know how to apply to scholarships. So now we have a course for that to teach them how to apply to scholarships effectively. We let them speak to young girls around the country about their experiences, and we have an on-the-road tour as well, and we go to schools and teach our younger generation how to be confident and how to just go after your dreams. And so the Yes She Can campaign is really just a group of young women who are just passionate about changing the world.
Do you have a favorite story where your campaign has, like, helped someone, like a story that makes you know, like, this had to happen, like, I did the right thing by creating this?
Yes. So a girl had emailed me about last March, and she said that she couldn't afford college and that she really needed help applying to scholarships. So I said, you know, I spoke on the phone with her. I said, here are some lists of scholarships. I gave her different advice of how to win them, because I've won a lot of scholarships. And I told her, like, just keep applying. I applied at least 10 a month, and I promise you, you'll get one. She called me back 2 months later and told me that she got a scholarship to go to college, and that if she didn't get that scholarship, she wouldn't have been able to go to college. And that just made me so happy. You know, I'm like, if we can get one girl to just apply to one scholarship, we're doing our job, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you can applaud for that. All right, so Danny, I love this one, because you mentioned to me when we talked before that the biggest question that people ask you is, when will women's sports leagues fail? So I need to know, how do you persevere in the face of such blatant negativity and bias? Like, when are you going to fail? When is your whole empire going to fall apart? Like,
yeah.
Who said that?
It's actually funny. We just celebrated our third anniversary. Our very first game was October 11th, which was yesterday, 2015. And some of the social media posts that I was reading were like, oh, we definitely thought this was going to fail. Like, congrats on your third year. And it's blatant bias. And I think what's difficult is being able to combat that. And the only way to combat it is to prove people wrong and be confident in your business plan and be confident that in the brand that you're building. And anyone who goes to a professional women's hockey game, they're shocked at the talent. And you know, they'll say to me, like, I can't believe how great these women are. And like, part of me, like, is almost upset when I hear that, because I'm like, what did you expect? These are Olympians. These are Division I college athletes. This is the best of the best in the United States and from around the world playing in this league. But I'm glad that they say that, because then they can help spread the word that this is not only a great talent on the ice, but when they look around and see the stands filled, or they look to see the thousands of people watching the streams live and the business that we're creating around the sport, it helps kind of continue to break down. So even if it's hand-to-hand combat, one fan at a time, it's making a difference. And I think that there's definitely more opportunity and a lot of improvement that needs to be made. Like I said, just yesterday, people were saying, you know, I can't believe the league's League's still around. So I think that just continuing to prove people wrong, prove your product, and keep at it.
So this is interesting. So the kind of bias that she just named is one of the examples of that is benevolent sexism, right? Where people think that they're giving you a compliment, but really it's like the backhanded compliment. Like, I can't believe how talented these women are. Excuse me, what did you just say? Like, do you even hear yourself? So it's good to be able to when you respond, when you hear something like that, like be able to name it in your head. And maybe the more we start calling people out and calling these things out when we hear them, like especially in the school context, one of the biggest challenges that we have is that, you know, it's essentially the when bias manifests, it's essentially a form of bullying, right? And the hardest thing for us as, you know, as students, as individuals, and even as adults, is to call it out and say something. A lot of us are just like, yeah, I'm gonna pretend I didn't hear that because I don't want it to come at me, right? So the extent to which you're able to call it out and name it and say, hey, you know, you may not be aware of this, but, you know, what you just said was kind of problematic. It takes a lot of courage to do that, but if you have it in you to call it out and help educate that person a little bit, then it's a great thing if you can. So I want to ask you, you said that you've got to keep proving people wrong. Can you talk to me about the role of data in like overcoming the bias that
you
had to face?
And I think the bias that we've seen, it's not just at the fan level, it's at the investor level, it's at the potential sponsorship level, it's at the media level. It was difficult being a brand new startup league in 2015. People, sponsors would ask, "Well, how many fans go to your game?" Well, we haven't played a game yet, so we don't really know. Well, how many people watch the games? Well, we haven't streamed a game yet or broadcasted. So being able to create that data and lead conversations with that data has been incredibly important to our growth and success, because numbers don't lie. If people ask, now, how many fans go to our games? We have that answer. If people ask, what our social media following is and what their expected return on investment would be, we have those answers. So I think that the more data that we can continue to generate is important to our long-term success, but also understanding that when you are a startup business or you're starting something new, how important it is to, yes, have an understanding of the potential market that you're talking to, but to create that data and rely on that data to make decisions and change the way that you, maybe operate your business or speak to potential partners, clients, investors, et cetera, or fans. So creating that data and leading with that data has been essential.
So I do a lot of mentoring of young people who are trying to find their way and figure out what they want to do in the world, and then entrepreneurs who are just trying to take things to the next level, and that is just always good news. If you're going to start a thing, and I think everybody's here to bring something to the world, and the journey is like figuring out what is your jam, like what are you going to share with the world that only you can share with the world, and we all have something. Data is so important. So from the beginning of, whatever it is that you start, just collect data and document your process, document what you do, because that will serve you. Have you found that data has been useful in your venture as well, Alyssa?
Well, it's interesting what you said, because I can kind of get on the back of that in terms of data with being a blogger and running a company that's not as much consumer-based but based on myself, that it's these backhanded compliments that I think is also an unusual form of bias. That's something as superficial as an Instagram following. The amount of sponsors I'll approach or brands or magazines or whatnot that will give somebody with a million Instagram followers who your mom and your grandma or whatever will never know and won't give me the time of day because I have a quarter of that or not even, but have built a brand with longevity for a while now, is really frustrating. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really annoying in a sense that you face the same things, especially at the beginning with the same amount of, with the streaming. You hadn't even started it. Certain things, and then other brands that have started that might have 100 people, but yours could be done even more successfully. So I think that's a bias that should be recognized as well, as is social media and how superficial that following can be, or that number with certain opportunities.
Yeah, and then when you get a number, you hold on to it. So one of my favorite numbers, we played our first game October 2015. December 2015, we announced our first corporate partnership sponsorship with Dunkin' Donuts. So we announced early December, and on the day that we announced, in 24 hours, we generated 54 million media impressions.
Oh my God.
Which is huge, and I didn't even know how big it was. I asked the Dunkin' guys, I was like, like, did we break the internet? Is that good? Like, they're like, this is amazing. And it was actually, it wasn't because they were backing, you know, a brand that they've partnered with before, like the Bruins or the Patriots. It was Dunkin' Donuts sponsoring the very first professional women's hockey league. And that was their brand saying that they believe in what we believe in. They have the same mission, the same vision that we do, and that they were gonna support that and back that. And to be able to shout that from the rooftops and like pull on that number to tell other brands, like, this is what we did for Dunkin', and they believe us, and they, you know, they see the opportunity here, has been invaluable. So I think that there are, you know, sometimes three types of people or brands, companies, the ones that believe in the change and they make change happen, like a Dunkin' Donuts or like everybody up here, the people who are kind of part of the movement, they're like, oh, like someone else did it, so like we'll do it now, like maybe after, like we'll think about it and jump in. And the people who are late to the game and just miss the movement altogether. So everyone in here that is a rally cry to be leaders, be change, be the people making the change. And if you don't make the change, at least, you know, be part of the momentum and the movement. Just don't be in the third group.
Awesome. Yeah. So Zaniya, can you tell us a little bit about the people, like, in your circle? Who do you keep around you? Because as much as it's like we're these awesome ladies who've started really awesome stuff, mm-hmm. and have been successful in some way, I don't think any of us have done it alone. So what is the importance of surrounding yourself with people, particularly in the context of you're facing this bias all the time? It's a full-on attack, mm-hmm. right? So who do you surround yourself with?
So I surround myself with diverse of people, but also people who are just passionate to change the world and who just doesn't want to be average. Like, you have to have people who want to just go above and beyond. You can't have friends that are just want to stick in the background, want to be average. Like, do not surround yourself with people like that. I have a friend who owns his own nonprofit organization. I have a friend that's a writer. I have a friend who's going to school, who travels to China to volunteer. Like, those are the people that you need to keep in your circle, because not only during the bad times, they will lift you up. And that's what the kind of friends that you need to have. And also, when you are starting a project, have a team. I know for me, when I started a community service club at my high school, I had a team. With the Yes You Can campaign, it's high school and college students as a team. And so when you have a team, you can't do everything by yourself. And that's what I learned as a leader. You have to make sure that you are also building leaders in your team as well, giving them different jobs or tasks to do, giving them a space to create their own programs. Because then, especially my organization, we're giving everyone a voice. And you have to make sure as a leader, you give all your friends a voice, but also make sure you have positive people around you.
And when you're building your team, look for people who are good at the things that you're not good at. Like, we want to gravitate towards people who are just like us, who like what we like, who do what we like, and that's why people like me are in business dealing with diversity stuff all the time. Because people will start a company and everybody will look and be just like them and went to the same schools. No. Get lots of different people, and if you're starting a project, you don't want to do the stuff that doesn't give you life. Mm-hmm. If you can find other people, like, I don't like numbers, y'all. Numbers and math, I think they're elegant and sexy and beautiful, but I can't do them. Don't like them. It takes way too much of that glucose, that brain glucose, won't do it. So I got like six people who deal with the numbers. Doesn't bring me life. They're good at it and they love it. Then everyone gets to do what they love and you grow faster. Mm-hmm. Do you guys find, you know, sort of any parallels there with who you surround yourself by?
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's important to find people who will also challenge you.
Yeah.
As a leader, you don't want a bunch of yes people around mm-hmm. you. And as much as you might enjoy hearing yeses or validation to your ideas or whatever it might be, surrounding yourself with people who are leaders, who you've empowered to speak up and have a voice, is so important to the overall growth of anything.
I also appreciate, I think when you're an entrepreneur, surrounding yourself with people who aren't entrepreneurs. I remember being in high school and I had no friends. I literally was eating in the bathroom every day. And my two of my best friends still now that have known me since before I even started my blog are what you would just consider the college bound opposite of me, did really well in high school and I did really poorly, not entrepreneurial people. And having those as well for that support where you just sometimes need a break when you're an entrepreneur, as well as surrounding yourself obviously with other leaders and stuff. But I mean, everyone has such an unusual brain and not everyone is an entrepreneur. So I think if you can have a balance of people, as long as they support you, whatever they do for a career, whether or not they went to college, then that's really fantastic to surround yourself with.
So Alexa, I want to ask you the last question before we move into our Q&A, and that is, it's about bullying. You talk on your platform a lot about bullying, and then also about mental health issues. Do you find that there's bias and stigma around talking about depression, anxiety, mental health issues?
Yes. When I first changed my website to be from fashion-based to talking about social media and mental health, I wrote this article that I, when I was 16, about an eating disorder that I had. This is before everybody was talking about all the different things that people are talking about now, bullying and sexting and cutting and all this stuff. People wanted to talk about it. Nobody just had the platform to do so. So I wrote it and it kind of went viral. And that's where I had this moment over 3 years where I was like, I really should start some type of project that was similar to the DARE system. But now, with social media, you can so openly talk about so many different issues, which is also great. But along with that, there are people with, specifically I've seen with some of the mental health issues, that don't have mental health issues, but I think that they can grow their following by promoting mental health issues or promoting whatever anxiety or depression they don't actually have. And I think that it's a very fine line between, if you're going to talk openly about having that you have actually had it, right? That you aren't saying you're anxious and then you've never actually really had anxiety or depression or talked to a therapist, unless you want to talk about that personally. But if you're going to take it to the next step where you try and advise people how to handle it, then that's where I think this blurry line has come in a bit, especially this year. But I think that right now, what I'm seeing so much with these kids is just the lack of resources they have to deal with these issues, which is why a lot of them turn to these online influencers and people they see on TV. But those are not real people, right? It's schools that should be giving kids the resources and the platforms to deal with the anxiety and the depression and the bullying, not letting them watch the Kardashians for one of them to mention 1 second about anxiety. These schools and our communities should be creating the leaders and pushing them towards these kids who need help. So I think that's what I try and strive to showcase, is that there are so many people out there who have incredible messages, and those people should be showcased and highlighted, like all of you guys and probably all of you guys and everyone speaking today, versus some of these people who are not dealing with these issues but want to gain more of a following.
So in that vein, in the world of mental health issues, depression, anxiety, I think yesterday or the day before yesterday was World Mental Health Day. I actually suffer with anxiety and depression. Those are actually invisible disabilities. It is worth, if that's something that you suffer with, it is worth going to your guidance counselor, your parents, whatever support system you have, and actually getting a diagnosis and getting support. Because what people don't realize is that it is an Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA. It is an ADA protected category. I wish I had known this going through school. It took me, oh my gosh, 5 universities, 10 years, 11 majors, and 3 minors to finish just my undergraduate degree. I'm Dr. Tiffany Jana today, but it took me 10 years to get through my undergraduate degree, because every time the big, scary, dark monster of depression and anxiety came up to bite me, I made straight A's, I'm a 4.0 student, but every time anxiety got me, I couldn't function, and so I would drop out of my classes or withdraw in order to keep from compromising my grades, and it took me forever, and sometimes I took years off, like it was awful. So understand that an actual diagnosis of depression, anxiety, the ADHD, all of those things, they are ADA protected categories, and that means that you will get accommodations throughout your education all the way through college. Depending on what it is that you need, you get extra time for tests, you get extra time to turn things in, people have to break down assignments for you, you can use computers in places where you're supposed to only write. There's a million different accommodations, but you will be taken care of, and that's something that you can carry forward into the workplace. If you suffer from anxiety and depression, sometimes you can't go to work, and you need to know that that is a protection, and you can go to HR and say, hey, this is something that I suffer with. I kindly appreciate you not share that with my colleagues, because I don't want to be bullied at work either. But they have to make reasonable accommodations for depression and anxiety, just like they have to do for blindness or any kind of physical disability. So that's some news you can use. All right, so we'd like to hear from you guys and make sure that we're spending this time well and giving you an opportunity to interact with these brilliant people. We don't have mics in the hall like we thought we would, so we're gonna. Oh, we do. We have microphones. Yes. All right. Fantastic. All right. So, anyone have a question? Raise your hand, and we'll get a mic runner to you. And of course, you'd be like right in the middle. All right. We're gonna get some mic runners. You can stand up and say it real big, and we'll just start there. Yeah. Woo.
Number of you mentioned that when there weren't necessarily opportunities in the available.
Big voice, biggest voice you got.
Sort of creating opportunities for yourself when there weren't necessarily those available in those places. And that's something that I've heard a lot, is sort of creating opportunities for yourself when there might otherwise not be some. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering sort of what for you guys that looks like in the actual sort of actions that were taken.
You mean like how to create opportunities?
Yeah,
and come up
like
with
what
these
that
ideas?
Sort of looks like in like a sort of the practical sense.
A notebook. You guys probably vouch for that. I mean, go back to like the traditional stuff, books and notebooks. I used to sit.
Can you repeat
yeah.
Question?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Should I just say
yeah?
That?
Okay. Yeah.
So my question was, what does I guess like to summarize is what does like the creating of opportunities sort of look like in a practical sense, because I sort of have heard that as a lot of times that I'm not sure how to actually go about that process.
I would say notebook. Sit down and see where you envision yourself in 10 years, whether it's has to do with a family, whether it has to do with financially, whether it has to do with your career, and let that guide you.
Are you talking about opportunities for yourself or for the people around you?
Sort of like in general, like if sort of like if someone like had like a business and they were like denied that thing or something that they needed, and or like you mentioned like being like with your like the age thing, and then sort of what the actual sort of like not taking no for an answer or sort of creating like positions that might not have previously been there, sort of like how to actually go about doing that, because I'm not sort of clear on like sort of what that it would actually entail.
Okay. Yeah, I think that I've heard no so many times, and like the Dunkin' Donuts example that I gave, that started with a cold call, but they weren't the first and they weren't the last brand that I've cold called, and I think you have to believe so passionately in what you're doing, and have the grit and the perseverance and the ability to take those no's and let them, you know, roll off your shoulder and wake up every morning like asking again. And I think that that's how you continue to create opportunities. Because if you hear no a dozen or 100 times, then and you can't ask anymore, then that's kind of when you might have seen your path through. But knowing and you know believing so passionately in what you're doing is what gets you there. I love numbers. One fun number that I heard recently was 242. That was the number of times that the founder of Starbucks went out to VCs asking for money, and 243 was that was the number. So he heard. Starbucks heard no 242 times. Yeah. So that is motivation, I think.
So a Joseph Campbell quote comes to mind for me, and that is, follow your bliss, and where the world's needs intersect, there you find your vocation. So it's what Danny just said. You're not gonna be able to create every opportunity, solve every problem. So you've gotta find what lights you on fire, what makes your soul sing, right? Find that and figure out where the need in the world overlaps with that. Because if you're gonna pursue a thing and start a thing, it's gonna take, like you said, grit. It's gonna take perseverance. So you gotta be passionate about it. And it can be that aspirational positive passion, or when you see and hear things in the news, if it gives you, if you have a visceral response, it kind of makes you wanna throw up in your mouth a little bit, you're like, ooh, that's a problem. You can work on that one too. All right, thank you. Next question. Oh, that was one close to you. We have two runners? Okay. There you go.
Oh, dear.
Perfect.
Was there ever a time where you wanted, where any of you guys wanted to give up? And do you guys have any advice for someone that might want to give up, especially for maybe seniors and stuff like that this year? Because it is a very stressful year for us.
My senior year of high school, it was a great time, but then near the end, I started getting a lot of denied letters from colleges saying that I was rejected, you know, acceptance to their college, and my top three choices I was rejected from. And I was really sad, and like, I really wanted to give up, but then I realized I couldn't do that because education is the key to opportunity. So I decided to go to another college in DC, and I was supposed to play basketball, but that didn't work out, and I decided to create my nonprofit. nonprofit. But the next year, I decided to apply again to those three colleges, and I got in. So what I would say to you is to never give up. If you use YouTube, like listen to motivational videos, that helped me. Also, talk to your family and your friends. And also, if you also need help, you can contact me, and I will help you.
I would say that there are some days that are very difficult. And as long as you keep moving forward, that's what's important. So some days you'll crawl, other days you'll run. But I think being consistent in the path forward is what's important.
Yeah, let the rejection lead you. Mm-hmm. Make it push you instead of hurt you. Because like you said, oh, the Starbucks guy, I emailed 466. This microphone hates me. 466 producers I emailed last October, and I got one reply from somebody at Disney from a list that I found online. Same thing with the Starbucks dude. But that was 6 years of rejection for the smallest opportunity, not Disney Channel, Radio Disney, which is an in the door. But it doesn't make it any easier. Even when you get there, you just want more. So I think learning also to accept what is, but have such big goals that it's constantly like you're just pushing for more.
In sales, we say that every no brings you closer to your yes. Okay? I'm not in sales anymore, thank goodness, but you did learn that thing. All right, we've got one back there. Great, thank you.
When we talk about confronting bias, we talk about that heat that you're talking about, right? What tips do you guys have for successfully confronting bias versus getting into a fight?
You can go. You can
okay,
go.
All right. So that's what I don't wrote all these books about, so I'm going to say something. So what the thing to understand is that when you're triggered, like when the bias happens, you're triggered and you're moving into your amygdala, you're moving into your reptilian brain, which is the flight or fight response. Your cognitive brain, the higher functioning, and that part of your brain can't even operate at the same time. And we know this now because we can put people in MRIs and then make them really mad. And in the beginning, if you put them in an MRI and you're like, what would you do if someone slapped your mama? Oh, I'd have a nice conversation with them and tell them that that is inappropriate. Then you put them in an MRI, ask them the same question after you've pissed them off. They're like, I will kill them, ah! Right? So we can't even predict our behavior when we're triggered. So it's important to know that you've been triggered, to recognize those signs, whatever they are for you, and then you've heard the things to deal with that triggering response, and you just didn't really necessarily connect it to bias. But all those things that the people who raised you taught you: take deep breaths, count to 10, go for a walk around the block. You've got to get yourself out of that situation if you can. If you cannot remove yourself from the situation to give your brain time to go back up to its higher functioning, you can start asking yourself questions. Because when you're triggered in one of those situations, it actually has less to do with the person in front of you than it has to do with some past experience that traumatized you. So you're responding to this person in the moment, but really you're thinking about that knucklehead in the third grade who said you had yellow teeth. Okay, but something is upsetting you right now. So if you can say to yourself, why am I feeling this way? What am I feeling? Start asking yourself questions and make those questions as deep as you can. You don't want that voice, the one that eggs you on, like, yeah, I know what she's thinking. No, not that voice, the other one. Just sound like a professor and be like, what am I thinking? Why am I feeling this way? What past experience is making me pull this feeling forward? And then you can move forward and back in your higher functioning brain. But it's very difficult. Like, mm-hmm. there aren't any real shortcuts. Time is the greatest thing for moving beyond that space.
Yeah, and I would say that there are sometimes you can't even remove yourself from the situation because you're in a boardroom or you're in a meeting. And I think, yeah, the deep breath was going to be like my initial response. But then also realizing that, like, sometimes, like, when you will speak your mind and prove your point the best that you can, sometimes the other person on the other side of the table is a rational human, and they'll get there. Sometimes they're not, and sometimes you just have to let that go and kind of pick your battles, I would say. But it is nice when you have someone rational, like, oh yeah, that's a great point. I never thought of it that way, and then you can kind of bring your heart rate back down and move on in a great direction. But yeah, I think that the first breath, and then realizing when to just, all right, we have different views on that subject, and we agree to disagree and move on.
If you want to take a note, there's a book called The Four Agreements. It's an old book. It's a real skinny book. You can technically read it in like an hour, maybe an hour and a half, by Don Miguel Ruiz, and it gives you four tips, like four agreements that you make with yourself that it's the book I recommend more than any other book, and one of them is Don't Take Things Personally, because we have a tendency when like people attack us, they bully us, they say mean things, they want to trash talk, haters want to hate. That you gotta let that stuff go, y'all. You gotta let that stuff go. If I cared what people thought about my green blue hair, I would not be living my best life. Okay? Like, you've got to just let that go. The most important thing you can do is cultivate your sense of who you are, because who you are is freaking fantastic. You are the only one. And let somebody talk about you. You call me, you call Zanaya, yeah. You got your back.
You got you.
Shoot.
Hi. So I was wondering, you talked a lot about how you've addressed unconscious biases in your careers and just like in your paths in life. And I was wondering how, if you had any like personal stories of how you've addressed your unconscious biases against other people and maybe how that's affected you.
If you get Overcoming Bias, my book, you'll get stories of that, lots of that. First book, available on Amazon and everywhere books are sold.
It's a great question, though. Back to the boardroom, there are many times I'm sitting across from an older white male, and I'm like, yep, I've already summed you up. I know where this is going. And it's kind of like the same thing with like hearing no so many times, but having to say yes, or keep asking in hopes for a yes. You have to wipe the slate clean, because if you put them in a box, you're limiting yourself. Like I won't present as well if I know if I've already come to the conclusion of the meeting before the meeting even starts. And then sometimes people will surprise you too. So I think just the same thing, having a clean slate, any meeting that you go into or anytime you meet someone, it doesn't always have to be in a boardroom or in a meeting, but any exchange that you have with other people, just everybody's different. Everybody deserves a chance to prove who they are.
Yeah.
Hi. I was just wondering what your next big plans are. Because people like think, oh, I'm at the top already, but I just want to know like what you guys have planned coming up.
Well, I'm a junior at George Washington University, so I actually have to go back to school on Sunday. but I'm going to graduate next year, in 2020, and I want to be a lawyer, so I'm definitely going to have to start studying for the LSATs. Also, my organization just opened two chapters at Montclair State University and Rowan University, and we're having a Sparkle Summit on June 1st, and we're having different events throughout the country this coming year. And so my passion, my mission, just to keep climbing and to inspire others to overcome obstacles.
That's really cute, sweet that you say that, because I don't know, I feel like I don't know when I would ever feel like I'm not the top. I don't feel like I'm even a quarter of the way there, and it's 6 years. But I am planning these summits, so six different summits across the country, specifically starting on the East Coast, that are like college fairs with six different colleges, and then hopefully turning this Radio Disney show that I have into Interstitial, which is the middle of the programming you'd see on Disney Channel, within 6 months. That's what I'm really pushing for, but constantly rejected and putting down, being put down in sometimes that specific corporate environment that I've never been a part of, and hopefully getting a book deal within a year. I thought one was going to come through, and it didn't come through. They just really rejected me on Tuesday. It took like 6 months for them to say no, but I'm not going to give up. I want that book, so I'm just going to keep emailing 460,000 more people until one replies. That's all you need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think builders are going to build. Mm-hmm. There's no limit for what we all can do, and it starts with starting and then realizing that, like you said, you're never going to be at the top. Anyone who wants to be at the top realizes that there's still more room to grow. So, like I said, builders are going to build.
I think we have time for maybe one more question. Last one.
So, I feel as though that...
I'll talk right into the mic.
Okay.
You
got to
eat it.
Yeah. Can you hear me? Okay. I've learned, after everything we have talked about, that basically you taught me what to do, what obstacles to overcome in order to pursue. And my question is, what is success to you? Like, how do you define success? And do you consider yourself as successful, already successful?
Do you want to go or you want me to?
Do you want me to answer? Or you want to?
You can start.
I question that a lot. I have anxiety and depression that I struggled with my whole life, and I talk with my therapist every week about that, and it always goes back to the same thing. I really grew up with nothing, a very small town. My father was in prison, and I've built this entire life for myself with not one connection or $1. And I have always dealt with the financial thing, especially being an entrepreneur. When will it ever be enough money in my bank account that I can like buy my parents a house or run the nonprofit that I want and not have to do anything else on the side that's like my blog or a sponsored post? As much as I love doing that, I would like to run the nonprofit full time, and it will never be enough. So whether it's financial or whatever, it's learning to train my mind, I think, and accepting that even if I think it's never enough, that word happiness is like you're constantly on this journey to find what happiness is, whether you're like Amal Clooney or whether you're like me. And I think if you can surround yourself with people and find that happiness, for me, it's like being at home with my two best friends from high school and doing nothing and wearing sweatpants and like eating a ton of food. That's my happiness. And it's great to make a ton of money and do all this awesome stuff and empower people, but it's those little things that you have to, that bring you down to reality sometimes and make you realize that like, you have probably 80 to 90 years to do a lot in this life, and then it's over. So what can you do in that, and how can you find your own definition of happiness that everyone has a different definition of, if that makes sense?
For me, it's goal-driven success, and there are big goals, and there are small goals, and to carry on, you have to celebrate the small wins too. So like every weekend that we have a game and paid fans are showing up and the young girls are up against the glass, like so inspired by these professional hockey players. Like that's a small success for me. It's a huge success, but it's kind of a small piece of the bigger pie. But I mean, the bigger pie is, you know, driving salaries, driving revenue, making this an even bigger business, expanding to new markets. So I think it's important to have small goals and big goals and celebrate each milestone.
I also agree, but for me, I think success is more as the what are you giving to the world? Like, how are you going to change the world? How are you going to inspire and empower other people? For me, I've been able to accomplish a lot, but my success is being able for someone to tell me that I helped them in their journey, or my organization helped them win scholarships, or my organization helped them just can stay motivated to continue their education. That is really truly what success is, because when you are off this earth, what are you going to be remembered by? And I think that's what you should take away from this.
And I would follow up Zaniah and say that, like, so I happen to identify as Christian, so I'm very much that way. I'm here to serve. I'm here to, you know, build the kingdom, and I respect everybody of all religions that choose what they choose, but it's on the inside. If you're looking for your happiness and your success to be defined by the outside, you'll never arrive there. So going back inside, like Alexa said, and figuring out, you know, what makes your soul still and joyful, that's where you'll find your success. Let's give these women a round of applause. Thank you all so much. Go forth and be awesome.